We will continue with our docket. And I left my docket in the room, so he has a docket. You may approach Mr. Robbins and Ms. Tyson while I'm trying to get myself together. Case is Deborah Sue Altman versus the Commonwealth. Mr. Robbins for Ms. Altman and Ms. Tyson for the Commonwealth. Mr. Robbins, you wish to have any time in rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please, Your Honor.
Okay, you have that, sir.
Can you give me a moment, Your Honor?
Proceed when you're ready.
I'm John Robbins. I'm here on behalf of Deborah Altman. And this is a sufficiency of the evidence case, and I acknowledge that that burden is rather significant. As the court inquired previously, are the facts such that any reasonable judge would have found Ms. Altman guilty? And I suggest not. This is kind of a complicated case in that there were several charges all being tried at the same time. There was a driving under the influence charge. There was a what I call vehicular DUI manslaughter charge, of which he was convicted. There was also another involuntary manslaughter charge, which was dismissed. The issues before the court this morning are the sufficiency of the evidence twofold. First, was the evidence sufficient to prove that Ms. Altman was under the influence under any other code section other than section 1 or I of 18.2.266? And the second is causation. And I submit to the court that the Commonwealth went to great lengths to establish the BAC, the blood alcohol content, of Ms. Altman at the time of the offense. They introduced an expert, so-called, to testify about what is generally known as retrograde extrapolation, to show that her blood alcohol content at the time of the accident was above 0.08. That is unusual in driving under the influence cases. It's been my experience over the years that usually what happens is the Commonwealth introduces the breath or blood certificate to establish the blood level, and that is sufficient to prove a violation of 18.266. However, in this case, under the what I call the DUI vehicular manslaughter case, that the per se section of 0.08 is specifically excluded from that section. So the court must rely on other evidence. And the other evidence in this case consisted of testimony about some drinks that she had the night before. There were two hard drinks that she had at a local restaurant and several beers that she'd had the night before. The last one being she testified, or she stated in her statement, about 1 o'clock. The evidence of her intoxication at the time of the offense, disregarding the BAC testimony, was the odor of alcohol, or slight odor of alcohol, and her performance on the so-called standardized field sobriety tests, as well as what is generally known as the pre-exit test, which are the alphabet test, the countdown test. Her first performance on the alphabet test was not satisfactory. The second performance was. Her countdown was appropriate. So she's essentially passed the pre-exit test.
Counsel, can I interrupt you and ask you a question?
Yes, ma'am.
What about the rebuttable presumption under 18.2-269.3? The fact that the BAC could give rise to the rebuttable presumption.
Well, it's my position.
It's
permissive inference, but
right.
I don't don't think that's really relevant in this case because the BAC should not play a part in the involuntary manslaughter charge because it's specifically excluded by that code section. There's four codes, as the court knows, there's four subsections of 18.2.266, and they're Roman numerals 1, 2, 3, and 4. One is the only one that deals with blood alcohol content. The other two, generally under the influence of either alcohol or drugs or a combination of drugs and alcohol. And those are the three that fall into the manslaughter section. We're not appealing the DUI conviction. We're only appealing the manslaughter conviction. And again, the evidence supporting the driving under the influence charge is the evidence about the drinks the night before, the odor of alcohol, which is insufficient to prove intoxication, and a performance on these field sobriety tests. The only problem that she had on the field sobriety tests was she stumbled on step four on the walk and turn, that she used her arms to maintain her balance. And I submit to the court that that's insufficient under the case law to prove intoxication. Turning then to the issue of...
Why not the combination of this retro or the backwards-looking BAC combined with the...
Because the court can't consider the BAC in the involuntary manslaughter charge.
Where is that you can't consider it?
I mean, it may not be dispositive.
It may not be dispositive, but it's a piece of evidence, correct?
I don't think so.
And what's because your authority for that?
The wording of the statute itself, which is that you can only be convicted of involuntary manslaughter if you fall into the latter three categories, not the per se section. And her performance, even though her BAC at the time of the accident was above the .08, and her BAC at the time of the test was at .08, her performance at the time of the accident would suggest that she was not under the influence. So
well,
that,
give me the, if I understood the record, Mr. Robbins, is that she's driving down the road, she says she's distracted by a cup of coffee or something, and I thought that the record was or the testimony was in somewhat of conflict as to where the person was, whether he was along the side of the road or in the road, all of which the fact finder has to decide.
Yes, sir, and the fact finder in this case found that he was not on the road, although there's no evidence to support that.
Well, and I'm going back to my basic question, is the evidence sufficient to show that she struck the victim in this case and that striking the victim in this case was the cause of his death? Is that in dispute at all?
That's not in dispute.
Okay. So next we get is whether or not there is criminal culpability on her part in causing the death of this individual. Right?
I think you have to take it a little bit further than that.
Okay, but it either is or is not. She either is criminally culpable in causing his death, that is, her conduct caused the death, or because we know contributory negligence of the victim is not a defense in manslaughter cases. But if she's a causation of the death, then the only other thing we ask is it a criminal act on her part that caused the death, right?
No, sir. I think the question is whether her intoxication...
Forget about the intoxication. Is she keeping a proper lookout by a guy who's walking down this road that he's been walking down all these years, and suddenly she sees him in a moment in time she's unable to avoid striking him? That may be negligence, it may be gross negligence, or it may be a criminal negligence, or now we're getting into the involuntary manslaughter stage. And what I'm trying to figure out here is she criminally culpable in the cause of his death?
I think you could make the argument that she wasn't maintaining a proper lookout. That is a statutory offense. I think you could make the argument that as a result of her failing to maintain a proper lookout, or perhaps arguably failing to contain control of her vehicle, that that gives rise to some criminal culpability. But in that case, you're talking about the other involuntary manslaughter and not this one.
Okay, let me get to my next step, is that at what time do we last know that she had anything to drink? Alcohol?
1 o'clock in the morning.
At what time did the accident occur?
Shortly after 5 o'clock, I believe.
And did she sleep any time, do we know from the record, between the time she had her last drink?
There's nothing in the record about that.
So we don't know one way or the other from the testimony evidence presented?
No, sir. I believe it can be inferred that she slept because she was on her way to work, and that is in the record.
Go ahead and proceed with your argument. I'm sorry.
I'm in my
rebuttal time. You're certainly welcome to say that.
Essentially, briefly on the issue of causation, even though she may have been intoxicated under the per se statute, I don't think it can be shown that as a result of that intoxication, she caused this accident. That's the other issue.
Or it contributed any way to cause the accident.
Yes, sir, and there is...
Okay, I mean, yeah, you said you and I agree.
Yes, sir, and there is a case in my brief that talks about person walking along the side of the road. It's on page 12 of my brief, Russell versus Hammond.
Thank you.
But I'll defer to Ms. Tyson.
Good morning. May it please the court, the evidence was sufficient to establish that the trial court was not plainly wrong or without evidentiary support in finding the defendant guilty of vehicular manslaughter. And since this was tried under 18236.1a, the Commonwealth was responsible for proving the defendant was driving, she was driving under the influence, and there was a causal connection between the driver's intoxication and the death of another person. And the evidence established that. She was acquitted of the common law manslaughter charge. So what we're interested in is very narrow. Was she driving under the influence, and did that intoxication lead to the death of another person? And the answer to both of those questions is yes. I want to say one thing initially. Even at 6:43 in the morning, and I think the record shows the accident occurred around 6, because that's when the victim started walking towards the gas station to be picked up by his employer. So the accident occurred at 6, even at 6:43 when Trooper LaFond comes. This is on page 87 of the appendix. There's still a moderate odor of alcohol about the person of the defendant. She still had this odor of alcohol three quarters of an hour after the accident occurred, and more than 5 hours after she said she had her last drink. I certainly think that the finder of fact was entitled to disbelieve that the last drink she had was at 1 a.m. when she has this odor of alcohol this late, and then, of course, the blood alcohol result. Now, it is true that one cannot be convicted of vehicular manslaughter under 18236.1a if the DUI, if you will, statute that the Commonwealth proves is per se. If the only evidence that the Commonwealth has is 0.08, that is not sufficient. However, that does not mean that the blood alcohol content is not relevant to whether one is under the influence. And I think that is shown in this case by the fact that the expert came in and not only testified about the reverse extrapolation to establish that the blood alcohol content was higher than 0.08 at the time of the accident, but also the expert testified about what that means and what effect this level of alcohol has on a person's ability specifically to perceive, process, and react. So this is important when we look at just what evidence supports that her intoxication, that she was intoxicated, and then that intoxication caused the death. Although she said that she was looking down to get her coffee cup, it's important that in addition to the field sobriety tests and the blood alcohol content that she did not apply her brakes in a firm and force manner. And we know that from the testimony of Trooper Keene, who actually did the calculations to show that she was going 59 miles an hour with 3 seconds before the contact, 58 miles an hour 2 seconds before, and 55 miles an hour at 1 second before. There's not a rapid deceleration. And the reason this is important is that's very consistent with what the experts said that alcohol does to a person, because it slows the ability to understand what's happening, to process it, and to react to it. So we have a witness who sees the defendant swerving twice in her car before we know that the victim is struck.
Is that Turner's testimony?
That is Canty Turner's testimony. Yes, sir, it is. So we've got some bad driving. We have this failure to put on the brakes as one should if one sees a person who might be struck by your car. And then we do have the field sobriety test. She did fail initially at the alphabet test, had to do that a second time. She did fail at the walk and turn test, and she was able to perform the other tests.
Counsel, is there any evidence in the record that her medical condition had anything to do with her ability to perform these field sobriety tests?
No, there is nothing. There is evidence in the record that she was taking a number of prescription medications. She actually told Trooper LaFond that she had injected herself with a certain medication that morning, but there is not evidence that that would have affected her ability to perform on these tests. And it's kind of interesting because as police officers sometimes do, there was a discussion of appropriate footwear and lack of debris in the roadway so that these tests were properly performed and she was properly instructed on how to perform them. So when we look at all of this evidence under the governing appellate standard of the light most favorable to the Commonwealth and where the inferences are entitled, even the inferences are entitled to be viewed in that light, we do have sufficient evidence that this defendant was operating her vehicle under the influence, as that term is defined in 18.2.266, not the per se statute. Now, with regard to whether her intoxication was the proximate cause of the killing of the victim, the causation, of course, is a question of fact, as this court has held, and the finder of fact is entitled to make the reasonable inferences from the basic facts to the ultimate fact. And of course, there can be more than one proximate cause. The court questioned Mr. Turner about where he saw the victim the last time that he saw him before the striking. This is at page 58. And the testimony was that the last time he saw him before the accident occurred, he was between the white line and the grass. Now, there was some varying testimony from Mr. Turner. He gave a written statement at the scene. He spoke to Trooper LaFond on the phone. But, of course, as the Supreme Court held in the McNeil case, the fact finder is responsible not just for judging between witnesses, but actually determining within the testimony of a particular witness. We know that there were scuff marks and not skid marks on the road, which means that the tires were still turning as she was putting on the brakes. And we know that she didn't put on the brakes fast enough. And she didn't put on the brakes fast enough because she was under the influence of alcohol. She was not keeping her car under proper control because she was under the influence of alcohol. And so the evidence establishes both of those prongs, that she was under the influence as was required to be proven, and also that that was a proximate cause of the death. With regard to the case that Mr. Robbins noted, that Russell versus Hammond, which is a civil case, which seems to say that if you're a pedestrian, you have a sidewalk available to you, and you walk in the road and you get hurt or you get killed, that somehow that is contributory negligence and the person driving cannot be held responsible.
A lot of joggers should read that case.
Well, that doesn't help in a criminal case, however, because there is no contributory negligence in a criminal case in response to a manslaughter charge. In fact, in Hubbard, the court said the actions of the victim count only if those are the cause itself. And I think it's interesting that this court in O'Connell, which is the drag racing case from Richmond, the decedent in that case was participating in a drag race, and he didn't crash with Mr. O'Connell, but crashed into a tree, and O'Connell was still held liable and was still found appropriately convicted of manslaughter. And that victim wasn't just in the road, he was drag racing in the road, and clearly I think the Banks case is another one I think we cited in our brief, where the actions of the victim in a manslaughter case are really quite irrelevant unless they are the sole cause of his demise.
Counsel, what's your take on the applicability of 18.2-269?
Well, I must confess that I wish I had a code book with me to read what it
said. It basically says that in any prosecution for a violation of 18.2-36.1, the amount of alcohol in the blood of the accused at the time of the alleged offense shall give rise to the following rebuttable presumption. If there was, at the time, 0.08 grams or more per 210 liters of the accused's breath, it shall be presumed that the accused was under the influence of alcohol intoxicants at the time of the alleged offense.
Well, if and I guess since you just read that 18.236.1 is in that statute, I think that the important point is, yes, that is an inference that the court is entitled to draw for this case as well as an under the influence case. It doesn't, the 0.08 does not replace under the influence, because then we'd be getting under the wrong
little
subsection under 18.2-266. But still, in addition to being relevant, it's actually is elevated to more than just relevant. It is, in this case, a significant factor, especially because her blood alcohol content was significantly higher than that at 6 o'clock in the morning when the accident occurred.
Since we've displaced a permissive inference, I'm sorry, a rebuttable presumption with a permissive inference, and the fact finder, based on the evidence of the level of intoxication and the impact that would have on your average person, there was, regardless of the statutory permissive inference, here you had the evidence before the fact finder. So even if we displace that, fact finder could rely on the expert testimony to draw the inference or the conclusion that she was intoxicated.
Absolutely. And of course, what was significant in this case was that the expert went into some great detail about at what level of intoxication certain things happen and certain effects can be expected from one who is at that level.
I mean, my point is, I'm not sure we need the prosecutor needed the aid of the, and we as a reviewing court need the aid of the permissive inference when we have that kind of testimony.
Certainly, it is a factor at a minimum for this court to consider, and
among other things
that we see. So, actually, the driving is as well as the field sobriety tests, and so for all of these reasons, we would urge the court to find that the trial court was not plainly wrong or without evidentiary support in determining that the defendant was guilty of vehicular manslaughter under 18.236.1A. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Robbins?
Yeah. I was talking to my worthy opponent earlier and said, we could probably summarize this case by me getting up and say, no, it ain't, and she could get up and say, yeah, it is, and I get up and say, no, it ain't.
That's probably true a lot of these cases, Mr. Robbins.
We could have got through a lot of time, but at any rate, in rebuttal, if the court please, I'd point out a couple of things. First off, the scuff marks on the road were not attributed necessarily to Ms. Oman's vehicle. This particular section of Route 17 in Gloucester is very close to the entrance of a Rappahannock concrete facility, and there are a lot of trucks going in and out of that facility during the day and sometimes during the night. There was no evidence that was able to attribute the particular scuff marks that the trooper testified about to Ms. Oman's vehicle. Secondly, neither of the witnesses, as a matter of fact, both of the witnesses that were behind her testified they never saw her leave the road. Even though Mr. Turner testified about some swerving, he testified she didn't leave the road. Her swerving was between the white line, well, she's swerving in her lane, which way back when I was a prosecutor was probable cause for a police officer to stop somebody, but at any rate. And lastly, the expert did not know what effect the medical conditions that she stated she had would have had on her. 3 seconds on the road is a long distance. At 60 miles an hour, it's about, well, it's 88 feet per second is 60 miles an hour. So 3 seconds is well over 250 feet, almost the length of a football field. I don't know that her statement that she reached down to get her coffee cup, then looked up, and there he was, is necessarily attributable, and I don't think it is attributable, to her condition of intoxication. Her performance would suggest that, performance on the field sobriety test would suggest that she had a high tolerance for alcohol. I think the cases, and as well as the court, back when the judges of the court were in private practice, dealt with DUI, we're familiar with the people who can drink and not show it at all, and then those who can drink a little bit and it hits them, goes right to their heads. The expert basically says that doesn't make any difference. Everybody's the same. I don't think that's true. I don't think that this the issue isn't before the court. But I don't know that this retrograde extrapolation is recognized science. I think it's a lot of speculation, and the expert's testimony was contradictory in some places where he said everybody's the same, and then he said a lot of different factors apply.
But well, that ship has kind of sailed, though, right, counsel? I mean, in terms of the evidence came in and
that was came in, but
considered it.
Yes, the trial court did. But overall, I think the evidence does not support the conviction for involuntary manslaughter. That's all I got.
Thank you, Mr. Robbins. We appreciate both you and Ms. Tyson for your arguments. We'll come down and greet you personally to thank you, then take up the case.